From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2016, when the number of hate crimes rose significantly compared to 2015. That data comes from the FBI, which also reported that in 2018, the number of violent hate crimes rose to its highest level in 16 years. Researchers who study hate crimes and hate violence often view the numbers in relationship to authoritarian movements and what they can mean for our democracy. Eric Ward of the Western States Center and the Southern Poverty Law Center is one of those researchers. One can argue his work is more relevant in recent years than ever before. As Rochester grapples with the events of this past week and what's next for this community, someone like Eric Ward, who also studies police-community relations, may be able to provide some guidance. He will be the keynote speaker at the upcoming Summit to End Hate. The Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center is holding this event, and he will join us later this hour. But first, we'd like to talk with local participants about this event and about the issues facing our community and how they relate to one another. Joining us this hour, the CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester is Meredith Dragon. Meredith, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Karen Elam is the director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center to End Hate. Karen, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
Hello to Taj Smith, director of diversity education at RIT and member of the steering committee for the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center. Taj, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Kevin Beckford, director of staff diversity, equity, and inclusion at the University of Rochester and co-chair of the steering committee that we just talked about. Kevin, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
Certainly, Meredith, this feels more timely than ever, but give me a sense, you know, independent of the Daniel Prude case, this event was planned and for many different reasons. Tell us what the aim is that you hope to see accomplished with this event, Meredith.
Thanks, Evan. So, yeah, I mean, the timing, sadly, couldn't be any better. We've had this in the works for a while now. The Levine Center launched 2 years ago. And this Summit to End Hate provides our community the opportunity to really talk about all of the issues behind hate, racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, all of the things that we think about when we think about all of the isms, and understand that there is a common thread that runs through each of these things. And that is the issues concerning why people hate, how people can look to our differences to pull us apart rather than bringing us together, and understanding that we all have to be able to sit down together and talk about the things that actually bring us together, those things that we have in common rather than the things that pull us apart in difference. And this is just one piece of a whole variety of programs that the Levine Center has embarked on in the last couple of years to bring our community together.
The event is Sunday from noon to 5. What do people need to know about taking part and making sure that they are part of this, Meredith?
I'm going to pass that to Karen.
Yeah.
She has really been the organizer of this, and she can answer that question much better than I can.
There you go. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Thanks. Hi, Evan, and thanks, Meredith. Yeah, so basically, it's very simple. Go to our website, endhaterock.org, and right there you'll find the link to Brave Spaces. It will describe what we are trying to achieve. It will describe, you know, what Eric will be talking about as our keynote. Roland Williams will be our closing speaker. And then we have 12 different workshops for people to choose from. And I just want to note that what I find particularly exciting is that these are all sourced locally. We put an RFP out to our community, and we got an incredible response that has resulted in 12 different workshops by groups that range from faculty and students at RIT, from faculty at Monroe Community College, to folks from the National Coalition Building Institute, Partners in Restorative Initiatives, and the list goes on and on. Gandhi Institute, you know, we really have some terrific, terrific offerings. So I encourage people to take a look at our website and sign up. And the one thing I'll note is that there are a couple of workshops that are limited in size because we want them to be participatory. So those have been filled, but there are still many, many other options. And we will be redoing some of these smaller workshops later in the fall so that people that couldn't get into those now can get into those later.
What's the website one more time, Karen?
It is endhateroc.org. And then just right from the landing page, from the very front page, you'll scroll down, you'll find Brave Spaces. Rochester's Summit to End Hate. Click on the link there, and it will get you everything that you need to do. And if there's any kind of a question at all, just write to us at info@endhaterock.org.
Let me ask our guests to talk a little bit about what they're seeing in this community right now and perhaps how they see it relating to these themes, or if they do. Taj Smith, what we're seeing in the last week in this community is grieving, a lot of pain, a lot of anger, an urgency to actually make change now. Does it relate to the themes that you see coming Sunday, Taj?
Yeah, I mean, I think the work that we're trying to do is to educate, you know, create space for more dialogue and create space for taking action. You know, that's the mission. And so I think, you know, what we've seen of late is largely focused on race and racism. So embedded in that, we need to understand why hate manifests in that way. Why do people hate other people of different races? And if we can get to some of that matter, I think we can kind of tease out ways to prevent it from happening in the future. So, you know, that's the way I would see there's some connection in it.
Kevin Beckford, how do you see it? And frankly, I'm curious to know how you're feeling about what you've seen in this community for the last week.
I tell you, probably one of the more difficult periods. It almost feels like we've been transported back in time to the 50s and 60s. And I think that actually underscores why this work is so important. You know, hate is, you know, you can think of hate as like water. It doesn't actually have boundaries. It'll flow everywhere. And at the root of it is inequity, right? And the basic question I think we have to ask ourselves, not just in this community, but ultimately America, is the basic question of how were we able to, as a country, you know, allow for ourselves to actually have human beings that are in black and brown bodies to not be treated as fully human. And so that's one aspect of hate, which is huge, and it's a part of our historical sort of, you know, story of America. But hate also has no boundaries, right? And so one of the things that's really important with this, the Center for to End Hate, is that how do we look at hate in all of its forms, and to look at it through education, both dialogue, to be able to really get to a better sort of common understanding of equity, and also around positive action. What can we actually do as opposed to just talk about it? And so I'd say my heart is broken in a million pieces, because when I look at what, in fact, the video of Daniel Prude took Mr. Floyd and brought it home to us here. If you think about the anger and the feelings we had and over watching Mr. Floyd die in front of our, you know, on our screens and our TV and our phones, only to find out that before he died, we had our own Mr. Floyd here with Daniel Prude and his family. And so I think that it's created a sense of urgency, Evan, in terms of why this is important for us to really look at all of our systems and really look at our heart. I think the first system we need to work on is our individual heart, and to ask ourselves, you know, I've shared this, you know, in another forum. When I took a look at that video of the police watching Daniel in crisis, and we could hear the audio, all right, of, you know, and you could hear that nowhere in there was anybody saying, let's get him a blanket, let's talk to him. You know, that there was a lack of humanity, which is at the basis of hate, that allows us to do unbelievably inhumane things to other human beings. And so I think this is where the discussion has to start, in order to fix anything, is to ask ourselves, how do we allow this to keep happening?
Well, and let me just follow up on that one point that you make there, Kevin, because listeners may hear the word hate and think about that Daniel Prude tape. And for people who have paused with the word hate, let's explore this for a moment, because I confess I am someone who I try, and it's probably my nature, to see the good in people, to not assume the worst in people. And I think that generally serves me well, and sometimes it makes me naive. I don't believe those officers showed up that night wanting to hurt Daniel Prude or wanting him to die. What I do see in that video is an unacceptable lack of concern for a man's well-being, for his whimpers and his cries, and occasionally mocking what was clearly an episode in which he was struggling. So some people may define hate, Kevin, as, well, they didn't show up wanting to kill him. They didn't show up wanting to hurt him. But I think that it's important to kind of put a point on what you just said there, because even if they did not show up wanting to hurt him, he died in their custody. And that video, to me, doesn't show people who are all that worried about it. And I actually try to look for the good in people. I was shocked in the same way you were, but take me through the word hate as it relates to those kind of complex themes, Kevin.
Yeah, actually, I love that question because most people would say, I'm not a hateful person, right? Very few people would say that. But I'll use this analogy. Just imagine all those officers had on glasses, right? And this glasses has a prescription that has been baked into them over many, many years, starting from essentially growing up in this country with the social construct that devalues black and brown bodies, right? So that's their lens. So therefore, when they were looking at Daniel suffering, and you say to yourselves, how does this person who any of those officers, if you could follow them home that night, will hug and kiss your significant other or their kids or their family members? So they have the capacity to love, but they don't afford that capacity towards black and brown bodies. And it's because they've developed this essentially absence of connection to human beings in black and brown bodies, that they didn't see a human being in front of them. Now, I'm not saying they made that decision to do that. I think that they have not done the work internally to realize that they have essentially, over the course of their life, have developed a lens that does not value black and brown bodies and minds the way in which they should. And here's how to illustrate that point. When you watch that video again, and I would encourage anybody listening to this today, go back and watch this. But in the middle of that, just stop the video. And then imagine each of those officers, when they look at Daniel, they saw their daughter or their son, their significant other, their brother, their mom, their dad. And ask yourself, how long do you think it would have taken for not just one, but all of them to take off their shirt to cover up his body and to say, it's going to be okay. The EMT's on the way. Hang in there. And so what that tells you is that they have the capacity to love, but they don't afford that to people of color. And I think that's the discussion and the dialogue we need to have. And to kind of come a little bit full circle back to the program coming up, that is going to be one of the more difficult discussions we're looking to have, is we need to get to the grassroots of how do we allow ourselves to not see humanity in black and brown bodies and human beings that are black and brown bodies. Does that help?
I think so. And I'm curious to know if Karen, who's the director of the Levine Center to End Hate, sees it similarly. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question too, Evan, because I think we really have a visceral reaction to the word hate. And I think something that Kevin said really struck a chord with me when, Kevin, you said that people don't think they're hateful. And then I think you can replace that word with they don't think they're racist, and then they don't think they're anti-Semitic, right? And you can go down the line. And so I think that the ability to begin to peel away and see humanity in people that are other, and it requires work, you know, is really at the root of what we're trying to get at. The other piece I just want to make sure that I mention too is that while it is important for there to be individual change, right, to address individual racism, individual hate, we have to also look at the systems. And that's exactly what you were getting at, Kevin, when you talked about those lenses. And so, you know, this is not a summit that is only focused on what the individual, you know, is working on, but it's what do we work on systemically? And we have organized it that way. We have three groupings of our workshops. One is skill building. That's really, really individual. But we have systems change. You know, we have Shane Wiegand talking about the redlining in this community and where do we need to start making those changes, right? We have Simeon Bannister that's telling us, you know, about the true tale of two cities here. Where do we need to start leaning into the systems? Because we're not going to bring everybody along, and we have to work at the systemic and institutional and structural levels as well. And then the last grouping of workshops is really trying to bring us to a place of, we're calling it activism, organizing, and hope. because I don't want to leave people at the end of this feeling hopeless, helpless, you know. And I would, last thing I'll just say is, you know, I think that that the group, the young people that have been organizing in this community, are hope for us, that there can be change.
Tosh, do you feel that way? I mean, right now, is hope in the top 10 emotions on your register? Because for a lot of people, it sort of isn't. And I'm not sort of belittling Karen's point at all. I mean, I think it's vital. And I do think that there is a feeling that that there's momentum in some quarters to make change. How do you see it, Tosh? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think me personally, it's a combination of feeling hopeful and also having some righteous anger mixed in there, and other emotions. And so, you know, I think as human beings, we should be allowed to explore all of it. Now, I would say, I think one of the things we need to feel or experience hope is we have to have examples of that, right? And I think through this summit and other opportunities is about what are the examples that exist in our city, in our suburbs, in a larger region? And people need to be educated. They need to be informed about that. What happens is we tend to do things in silo. And so then if I'm in my silo, I have no examples of hope in that setting. But if I go across town or I go to a different community, I learn what they're doing, then that might inspire more hope for me to kind of continue on to do this work, you know, but no doubt there are other emotions that, you know, have to be at play when you see such injustice going on. But I would say, you know, if we can build up that hope within ourselves by saying what other people in our lives are doing, we can have conversations to help each other increase our own sense of hope, you know, that's really critical.
The event is Brave Spaces, Rochester Summit to End Hate, and it's coming up this Sunday from noon to 5. And you can jump on the website that I'm going to ask Karen one more time, probably many more times. Karen, go ahead. But the website again for people to see the schedule and to learn more about this. Go ahead.
Sure. It's endhateroc.org. And that's our landing page. You'll find everything that you need there. Evan, can I just add one more point
to the hope
issue? I want to point to an article that that Eric Ward, who is our keynote speaker, just published recently, called What If We've Already Won the War? And I'm happy to send you a link for folks to get to it. And his thesis, and I don't know that he'll talk about this, and I don't particularly want to steal his thunder, but it struck me so much because he said he's not naive. He's appalled by the shooting of Jacob Blake and the protest in Wisconsin and, you know, go back to George Floyd and now our own moment with Daniel Prude. But he says, I'm concerned about rising authoritarianism. And he goes on, but he says, we can't be blind to the signs of change that we've already experienced. He said, in the 14 weeks since George Floyd's murder, the Black Lives Matter movement has been propelled onto the global stage. There's legislation that carries his name. There's change in police. But, you know, so I think, you know, I'm not going to read the whole essay, but I think it's important. You know, he says in this article that he's not naive, but at the same time, if we don't start accounting for the change that we're seeing, we'll get bogged down in only the negative instead of seeing, why don't we say, you know, we're making some movement. And I know, I don't mean to be Pollyanna, and I know that we're only in the beginning of a very painful episode here in Rochester, but I also think we have to look at the positives that are already beginning. There's so much healing, and I appreciate what Tosh said. Absolutely. Righteous anger. And I don't know that experience because I don't live in black and brown skin. So I can appreciate it, but I can't experience it. But I do think that what Eric is saying here is we also have to have our eye on that prize of inclusive democracy and recognize when we have the movement going in the right direction, even if it's small steps. So I just wanted to get that out because it's a really fabulous, I think it's a fabulous thesis.
Eric's going to join us in just a few minutes. And before that, I do want to ask Meredith Dragon, the CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester, a question, sort of a broader question about what we can actually hope to achieve as a society. And I guess I'm just going to kind of go through my thoughts kind of clumsily on this, but a lot of people in the last couple of weeks have shared and reshared some of Francis Fukuyama's writing. He wrote in the 1990s a book called The End of History. He was associated at the time with the neoconservative movement. He's largely disavowed that now. But one of the ideas that he was positing was that we are, as a species, we've had centuries of war and strife, and that we might have been, at least in the 90s when he was writing about this, approaching the end of that kind of history, that we could actually see democratic pluralism, we could see a large-scale end to people who were not only at war with one another, but largely in societies with a lot of poverty and pain and suffering. And that if we did that, one of the ideas that Fukuyama was positing was that human beings need some kind of strife to kind of fight against, some kind of cause, and that absent war and large-scale suffering, that we would invent it for ourselves, and that we would never be happy, and that we would always find ways to turn against one another, sometimes even latching onto authoritarianism. And I think the reason that Fukuyama's work's been shared a lot lately is because, well, are people actually latching onto authoritarianism without realizing it? Are they supporting authoritarianism? Are we inventing this otherism? I'm probably oversimplifying his work and some of the analysis of it. But I also don't really accept this idea that we cannot build a society that will ever be lastingly pluralistic and happy and even egalitarian. I don't accept that. I don't accept this idea that human beings will always seek some kind of cause to strive for and that we can never be too comfortable and that we'll always end up turning on one another. But I mean, I see the anti-Semitism in the world and I see the racism in the world and I see that kind of struggle. And I wonder if you think it's achievable that we can build a society that doesn't eventually turn on one another for our differences.
Evan, that may take, about 10 days worth of programming to cover.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. It's a really great and important question. And I guess, I sort of live my life as an eternal optimist. But at the same time, I keep my eternal optimism tempered by my father, who's a retired history professor, whose favorite line always was, "Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it." Mm. And I think human beings are human beings, and I think that we naturally, as humans, have the tendency to have a fear of the other, and there's always an other. And I think if you look across society, we tend to group ourselves in those with whom we find comfort and have similarity. And it's hard to get out of our own comfort zones. And I think when we don't get out of those comfort zones, we have the tendency to judge others and to decide that there are things that we don't like about the other because we just don't know or understand it. And I think that there's probably a happy medium there in those two perspectives of a need for strife or a society totally absent suffering. And I think what we find is that happy medium in the middle is a personal understanding that we have to be open to looking at difference, getting out of our comfort zone, understanding the other, knowing the other, appreciating the other, and not fighting the other. But I do think there's some natural inclination to resist knowing who the other represents. And I think when that goes unchecked is when we end up in situations where there is real strife. Mm. And, history is cyclical. The world is cyclical. I'm not sure if there is an end in a world absent suffering. I'm also not sure that we'll ever end up in a place where there is, total utopia. But I think where we can make a difference is with individuals understanding that we all play a part in making our world better and that we can't just rely on the systems around us. We can't just fix the systems because the systems are made up of people. And we as people have to take responsibility for ourselves, for our communities, for our own actions, and for our own education. And it's incumbent on all of us that we recognize our own responsibility.
Yeah, and that goes right back to what Kevin was saying about the systems versus individual response when we see the tape of Daniel Prude and the system that says this training is okay, that this is how they were trained, also the individual expectation that you can put a blanket on someone who's freezing and suffering.
Right, and just to go back to what Kevin said, because I think it's so important, is that it's our responsibility. There's this notion in Judaism that we are all created in the image of God. And if we actually look at the world in that way, it helps us actually see the humanity in others and recognize that there is humanity in our communities, and that it's our responsibility to take off the lens through which we see the world and recognize that we have to be humane and we have to see the humanity around us.
Karen is kind enough to cede her spot on the panel as we welcome Eric Ward in our second half hour. So, Karen, I'll say goodbye to you now. Thanks for making the time, and thanks for joining the program this hour.
It's actually Meredith that's going to step
it's me.
On.
Oh.
If that's okay? If that's all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Bye.
Meredith, my fault. Thank you, as
no
always.
Okay, no problem, Evan.
Meredith is CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. We'll let her go. We'll take our only break of the hour. We'll come back and talk to Eric Ward from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's going to be keynoting this event on Sunday. Brave Spaces, Rochester Summit to End Hate. We'll be right back in a moment on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, three members of Rochester City Council join us, including the president and the vice president of council. They have some serious decisions to make coming up when it comes to everything from a new police chief to expectations for policing, an investment in a new substation, and expanding the police force, at least structurally, or pulling back. Members of council join us to discuss this and more next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The event on Sunday is Brave Spaces, Rochester Summit to End Hate, and that's brought to us by the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center to End Hate. It is free, and you can jump on the website to see the full lineup, and it will include Eric Ward, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and executive director of the Western States Center. Most of the speakers and leaders on Sunday are locally based. Eric is not. He's keynoting, and he's with us now. Eric, it's nice to have you. Thanks for making the time.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having us.
Now, you're joining an event in Rochester at a time when our community, fair to say, is in crisis. And you work across the nation understanding hate, understanding police-community relations. How do you view the events in Rochester and the responses to them that you have been able to glean, Eric?
I think it's important to note that we're in a very significant moment in our nation. We are in many ways, debating in healthy ways and in unhealthy ways, what it means to be an American and what does it mean to move forward as an inclusive democracy, meaning people-centered, transparent, and accountable. We're doing that at a moment of great changes in our society and in our world. So there is understandably anxiety. There is anxiety around demographic change. There is anxiety around economic inequality. There is great anxiety around social inequality. But we best move forward together. This should not just be seen as a hard moment. It is also a moment full of potential and opportunity. Whether we are talking about inequality in terms of racism or other forms of bigotry, at the end of the day, we are a country. We are a united country. And it is in the best interest of all of us to find ways to move past the partisanship and to hold on to our values. There are stories to be told in all places around the country. Rochester is no different, where it deals both with institutionalized forms of social discrimination and racism, hate crimes and other forms of bigoted violence. You are not alone in that. What makes you unique is that you have residents and leaders who are rolling up their sleeves and saying, this is not a moment to be divided. This is a time to find each other and to move forward.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that moving forward. And I want to relate it to a presentation that you gave in April of last year. You mentioned a T-shirt that one of your friends wore that said, "Not my mama's civil rights movement." And you said that shirt was correct. Your parents' civil rights movement was badass in ways too hard for us to conceive. But in a very serious note here, there is – I don't want to draw too bright a line generationally, Eric, but just this morning, the former mayor of Rochester, Bill Johnson, an African-American who is now in his 70s, he is helping lead a local commission on race that was appointed just a month ago. He gave a news conference this morning in which he said that the leaders of Free the People Rock and Black Lives Matter, who've been organizing these nightly demonstrations for a week now, he said that the most productive thing they could do now is to maybe take a break for a night or two, and instead of marching at night, focus on coming to the table to negotiate during the day, because there's a lot of power and leverage in this moment, and that this is the time to come to the table and negotiate and make change happen, and not necessarily just march every night. Now, they have essentially said, we've put our demands out there, and we will keep marching every night until the list of demands is met fully, period, end of story. There does seem to be a bit of a generational divide on how this change might happen. How do you see that?
Yeah, it is not unique. That type of difference of opinion existed in the midst of the 1960s civil rights movement. Taylor Branch and his seminal series on the civil rights movement, he's a historian, kind of took us through some of the inner tensions of the civil rights movement. Today, I think it's important for those tensions and debates to continue to happen. But I think we are all focused, I would say, while we are not all in full agreement or, you know, 100% aligned, I think at the end of the day, whether we are talking about the movement for Black Lives on the streets or those who have worked on civil rights policy and laid, quite frankly, much of the groundwork upon which some of this change is happening today. I believe that at the end of the day, both sides are trying to make our communities stronger. They're trying to make them safer. And our job is to figure out which path we are going to walk. Look, I am a proponent of civil disobedience and mass civil disobedience that is committed to nonviolence. You know, but I am also a person who understands that at the end of the day, right, this is about making structural and policy changes. And this means advancing policy. I think for those of us who say there are alternatives, and I certainly am a person who's argued that there are alternatives for street protests. The onus is on us to prove that those alternatives actually function in our society. As I've said to elected officials in Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere, it is very easy to point to folks marching on the streets. We know it's disruptive. It is meant to be. It's exhausting. It is meant to be. But these young people are trying to tell us that something is wrong with our society, and leadership means leaning in and addressing those problems and removing the reasons for them to be out on the streets every night. That's our work, and we should take our work seriously. And I'm glad to hear that there are, in fact, leaders in the community who are doing just that.
Yeah, and we talk a lot in this program about how to reach people who may have different views than us. You know, right now, if you look at the hundreds and sometimes thousands of people in the streets of Rochester every night, almost universally, peacefully, but urgently calling for change, that's a lot of people. But we also look at Gallup polling from the last month that still finds a real debate among Black Americans about whether, generally speaking, Black Americans want more or less or the same amount of police. I mean, Black people in this country almost always say they want better and less racist policing. But it's not a monolith. And so this is still a moment. This is still a moment where even people who want change and are leading these movements have to galvanize not just people who already agree, but have to convince others that the change they seek is achievable and will accomplish the goals they want. Now, you've had conversations not only with people who might be similarly aligned, but you've talked to people like Floyd Cochran, a former ranking officer in the Aryan Nation. I mean, you've talked to just about everybody from, quote unquote, your side to all sides. And even sometimes seeing people change their views. In your mind, what is it that makes people actually start to change their mind about how the world is working, who's been treated well and not, and what might change?
Yeah, I am humbled that I have been in a place where I've had the chance to sit down with people across society, in all sectors of society. I often say there are very few folks that I will not sit down and at least listen to and to hear whether I agree or don't agree with them. You know, I would say this. One of the things that we have to hold is a little bit of humility in terms of our own contradictions. All of us carry contradictions in thoughts, right? In our behaviors, our aspirations are not always matched by our behavior. That is part of being a human. What makes us good human beings is trying to align our behavior as close as we can to our aspirations. In my over 30 years of doing this work, I have watched white nationalists leave the white nationalist movement, including individuals like Derek Black, the godson of David Duke. David Duke, a longtime Klansman, white nationalist strategist in the United States. And my sense is ultimately what allows people to leave are real alternatives. And we are right now in our society dealing with some very tough issues, whether we are talking about over 50 million Americans who have been out of work over the last 6 months, whether we are talking about 190,000 Americans who have died from COVID-19 and the impact that has on their families, or whether we're talking about a very contentious political election. It's a very tense time. And those who leave kind of white nationalist movements or other hate groups are ultimately folks we help understand that this is not a debate. This is not about Republicans versus Democrats. This is not about liberals versus conservatives. There is no race war coming to America. What we are mainly dealing with are just Americans who want to live, love, and work free from fear and bigotry. And it doesn't matter whether you are a 68-year-old white veteran living in rural upstate New York, or whether you are a 17-year-old trans Latina living in New York City. Likely both of you are facing job discrimination. Both of you are facing issues around history, around health, around housing, and both of them and everyone in between deserves a better life. And that's really ultimately when folks tap into that understanding, into that type of responsibility to our society, that they tend to leave their hardened ideologies behind and begin to enter a space that I call the common good. That's where our country finds its solutions in the society. This is where we face the hard problems. And I think the Levine Center's conference is a space where that is going to happen. It's a chance to talk about how hate crimes and hate violence actually undercut the ability for us to reach common good and how we respond to it in ways that are healthy and provide safety and stability to our communities at a time where there are those who seek to tear our communities apart at the national level. Our communities matter. It's where we live. It's where we work. It's where our neighbors are. It's where we can make a difference. Doesn't matter whether you're a Republican. Doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat. It matters that you care about your community and everyone who lives in it.
Eric Ward, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and executive director of the Western State Center and the keynote speaker of the upcoming event sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center to End Hate. Eric, we'll see you virtually. Thanks for joining us today on the phone, and much love to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Eric Ward and Karen Elam. For people who've been listening, including Benjamin, who wrote in asking about participation, he says, this all sounds like a beautiful and engaging set of workshops, but is it now limited to only the participants? How does How does the community get involved? It seems as though without that, the good can be limited here. Let's talk about how people can get involved, Karen, whether they want to hear Eric or others.
Sure. So I'm not sure I entirely understood the question, but the beginning step, I would say, is to get on the website, register for the summit. So to hear Eric, as well as, you know, choosing from three different sets of sessions of workshops, and then we have a closing speaker, Roland Williams. That's a starting point, and then we will have information the day of the summit about further programming that we are developing that is really designed to bring us together into dialogue with one another. I just want to say one quick thing. I really appreciated the last thing that Eric said because it tied back so beautifully, and he probably doesn't realize this, to our speaker in the fall when we had Arno Michaelis and Pardeep Kalika here with us for our Why Do We Hate launch event. And Arno was a former white nationalist who left the movement. And so much of what Eric talked about, you know, that opening that Arno experienced where he really stopped seeing the other as a threat and fearing others, and the open, really just heart that he has now is remarkable. So I just wanted to throw that in there because it struck a chord when I listened to what Eric just said about that.
Well, let me get a phone call from a listener who's been waiting to join the conversation. In Rochester, this is Miguel. Go ahead, Miguel.
Hello. I just wanted to say that, you know, through history, American history and beyond, there's always been a George Floyd in America, and there's never been a law. The law has always been complicit with it. Like, even now, it seems more about capitalism than it is racism. Like, I feel like capitalism is the biggest discrimination now because we all discriminate against each other. And not many of us have access to it. I was born poor, and it wasn't my fault. But the world still stigmatizes being dark-skinned and being poor. And that's the biggest problem in America, because it's always been a group of people who's always had money. All the people in the presidency are connected through bloodline. There's always been a family. So by us to say that it's just made up of people, it's not just people. There's certain people in the government who have power, and there's certain people who have less power. And that is why America is still dealing with this racism now.
Yeah, Miguel, the phone's sort of in and out on connection. I think we got the point, and I'm going to kick it to Kevin and Taj to respond. Kevin, I'll start with you. Can we in a capitalistic system largely eliminate hate? I mean, Miguel is feeling that level of inequality is sort of perpetrated by this system and that it's almost designed that way, whereas people who work in organizations, for example, like conscious capitalism, say that they can acknowledge the problems and work incrementally toward change. How do you see it, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's a great question because we're much more empowered than the system would lead us to believe. So conscious capitalism is just a recognition of people that are practicing capitalism, and it's a spectrum, right? But they're practicing it from a more conscious, equity-based approach. And so therefore, at the end of the day, and as a leader, I can tell you this definitively, that you have an opportunity to make a decision when you're a leader and how you're going to make those decisions and if it's going to be baked in with equity or if it's going to be baked with bias. And so it is possible for capitalism to yield the result of equity that we feel that is elusive today, because it really is asking the leaders, CEOs, COOs, folks that are in positions of power, position, and authority and agency, to do the internal work to say, what sort of world do we want to see? And if it's one that's baked in inequity, it's very simple. You just make decisions that are absence of bias, which takes work, right? Because we're all big, you know, we all have bias. That's part of how the human condition works. And so we have to do the actual work to make sure that doesn't happen. But I think it is very possible, because I know I've been in leadership roles where when I took a look at the income for my employees that I inherited when I took over a new role, I saw inequities for the folks in the low end, and I just put together a plan to say, nope, I want to make sure we're paying a livable wage. Why? Because it's equitable, because it doesn't make sense to have people that are on the low end of the skill or pay scale to not have a livable wage. And so you just decide to do that and you do it. what's really missing is that sense of responsibility that people will donate on Sunday at church and pray for in church. But when I go to work on Monday and forget that you actually are making decisions that could bring about equity, so you don't need the donation. You don't need to do the work by making sure that we do the right thing. And so I think it's very, very, very possible to make sure that, you know, that leaders and people, individuals, see the personal responsibility we have in creating a more loving and equitable world.
How do you see it, Taj?
So, yeah, I think it's not an either or. You need institutional change and you need individual change. So I would first say with that. But I think it brings up a point where, again, at the Levine Center, we're trying to look at multiple kinds of oppression and look at how they intersect. And if we have that kind of conversation analysis where we are looking at racism, we are looking at, you know, how capitalism impacts people and other isms, that might be able to help us really understand how to collectively break down this larger system that plagues everyone. And everyone is sort of marginalized by it. So I really appreciate, you know, bringing in, yes, it's just not about racism. It is about other isms. And how can we, you know, intellectually and practically, you know, think about how all those forms of oppression, you know, come back to really impact everyone and build more of a collective interest rather than this sort of individualistic kind of approach, which is in the DNA of our country.
We've got a few minutes left here. Karen Elam, the director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center to End Hate. When I look down the list of workshops and some of the themes, there are well over a dozen, it looks like to me here, going on Sunday. How do you want people to decide what they can participate in between noon and 5?
That's a good question. Can I just take one step back, and I just want to respond to your caller as well
It's
so interesting, the question he poses, because we just finished, and I hope Danny Reddick and Nick Moore, who are facilitators with Partners in Restorative Initiatives, I hope maybe they're hearing this. We partnered with PRE to create what we called a study group to end hate. And Danny Reddick did just incredible work putting a quote curriculum together and gave us readings, including bell hooks. And one of the things that bell hooks talks about is the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. It's a mouthful. And we really, really dug into some of that, talking about these systems. And so this was, you know, I joined that group. It was folks from across the community, had weekly sessions via Zoom. Unfortunately, couldn't be together. But we really did start trying to do some, what I told Danny, sort of the intellectual analysis to bring it together with sort of the emotional analysis in this work that we need to be doing. So I just wanted to put that out there because I really appreciated his question. And I think he's absolutely right that we can't simply look at one aspect. It's really sort of, you know, the intersection of all of these various systems that we need to be addressing. All of that is long-winded. I want to come back to your question about who chooses what. What I really encourage you to do, we put a lot of work into describing each of these workshops. Everyone that is facilitating these workshops responded to our RFP, provided all this information. They have put so much work into this. I would ask people just take some time to click on every link, even if you don't attend that workshop, or if that one in particular is full now, and get a flavor of what we're offering. And then go to what really resonates for you. We have intentionally created a real wide menu, again, with total gratitude to this community for responding in the way that they did. We had no idea that we'd end up with 12 workshops, and that's what we got because people really put themselves out and said, we want to participate in this as facilitators. So I would say look at our website, go through, and then pick what really, really, really speaks to what you want to do. And be in touch with us if there's a session that is full and you say, you know what, I really want to go to the Becoming an Anti-Racist session. I really want to go to the Restorative Practices session. It's full. What do I do? Because we're going to work on getting those ready for more opportunities for people to join us.
All right. And the website has all of that. And again, if you've missed it, it's the event Brave Spaces Rochester Summit to End Hate, Sunday, 12 to 5. The website again, Karen, for people who've been asking?
Sure. EndHateRoc.org.
Okay. And it's an opportunity to make it clear, listeners, this was not something that came from any one event? Or maybe let's close with that, Karen. This wasn't something that you created, that Taj created, that Kevin helped create because of one singular event. I mean, these are themes that you've been working on and will work on regardless of individual events. Is that right?
Correct. And I think, as Meredith said early in the show, this has been a long time in the making. We had this idea to have this summit months and months ago. It was obviously going to be an in-person thing. We, you know, had to pivot to do this online. Obviously, that's not the most ideal, but we really felt we needed to go forward with it. And, you know, as circumstance would have it, I actually think the timing, given the tragedy that we have become aware of in this community, makes this an even more important opportunity for people.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests, and Meredith was able to come back in at the end there, and of course, a more organized host like myself would have had a better list.
No worries.
Meredith is the CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Meredith, I always appreciate the time from you. Thanks for making time, and we appreciate having you on the program.
Thanks, Kevin. Evan, can I add one quick thing?
Yeah.
I want to make sure people understand that Brave Spaces is open to the entire Rochester community, that even though it's hosted by the Jewish Federation, the Levine Center, that it's for anybody. And we want everybody, regardless of who you are, where you live, what you believe, there's something there for you. And we want you at the table with us.
Wonderful. Thank you,
Absolutely.
Meredith. Karen, thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Taj Smith, thanks for making the time. Taj, great talking to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Kevin Beckford, I always appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Short break, and members of Rochester City Council join us next.